Innocent, cynical instrument who makes the gun into a sacrament. The only response to the deification of tyranny by so-called developed nations, idolatry of ideology. North, south, east, west, kill the best and buy the rest. It's just spend a buck to make a buck. You don't really give a feeble. Open for business like a cheap bordello, and they call it democracy. 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 You see the loaded eyes of the children too, trying to make the best of it the way kids do. One day you're gonna rise from your habitual feast to find yourself staring down the throat of the beast they call a revolution. Making certain that there's one thing left. Keep them on the hook with insupportable debt. And they call it democracy. And they call it democracy.
And that was Bruce Coburn with They Call It Democracy. And my name is Nisi Shizenji. The usual host of the program, Reasonable Man Stan. Some of you may recall that I subbed for him a few times in March and April. He was on a bit of a leave of absence. And today was going to be our first time co-hosting the program. And unfortunately, I found out just about 90 minutes ago that there was a family emergency. And so Stan is not able to be in studio with me tonight. So Stan, if you're listening, I hope everything is okay. Take care of yourself. Take care of your family. And but also what that means is I had prepared to co-host and I had not prepared to singularly host. So in true fashion of community radio, we do the best that we can with what we've got when we've got it. So I'm going to do my best to make this an informative and engaging and hopefully interactive couple of hours. I have a number of topics that I want to address, and I'm certainly going to be welcoming telephone calls, just as Stan does, if anyone would like to weigh in. And then at 7 o'clock, I'll be joined by award-winning journalist Howard Harrison. He has written a book called Now They Make It Legal, Reflections of an Aging Baby Boomer. He's going to be joining us as a call-in guest at 7, and he'll be talking about such things as the similarities and differences between the political upheavals of the 60s and 70s and the 2016 election. He'll talk about his frustration with the legalization process for marijuana, talk about why the two-party system is tearing our nation apart. So Mr. Harrison has a number of things that he will be conversing with us about. I did have the opportunity to read his book and found it very entertaining. As a person who is at the very kind of at the tail end of the baby boom generation, I do remember a lot of the things that he talks about in the book. Some I didn't, but a lot of it I did, and it's really pretty entertaining. Okay, so I wanted to start off the program talking about something that happened last Friday morning. The Obama administration issued a mandate that said any school that refuses to allow any public school that refuses to allow transgender students or employees to use restrooms and locker rooms of the gender they identify as could lose federal funding. And this was done under the auspices of Title IX. Title IX came into effect way back in the early 70s. Basically, it says, no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. I'm not going, there are so many different things about this mandate that came out last Friday morning that could be topics for conversations, such as, is it appropriate for the federal government to basically tell states what they need to do? Is Title IX really the best route to getting to equality for transgender persons? And these are not the things I'm prepared to talk about. If you want to call in and weigh in on that, feel free. But really, I wanted to use this more as an opportunity just to do some education about transgender people. This is the thing that I think I have maybe a minor complaint with about this mandate, and that is that it was issued, but it doesn't seem like there was any education around it. Not surprisingly, Texas, the governor of Texas, whose name I'm blanking on right now, was the first to come out and say, we're putting this through the shredder. We're not paying any attention to it. And other governors have followed suit. There have been protests launched by students voicing concerns such as it's dangerous to have boys coming into the girls' bathroom and all they have to say is, hey, I feel like a girl. And this is, I think, a tremendous misunderstanding of both the intent of this policy and also of what transgenderism is. So I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about that. And I feel like the education piece might have been really helpful. How that would get accomplished, of course, that's a whole nother story. I think it could have been done, but it just seems to me that launching something like this without really preparing the people who are on the ground and dealing with this, such as in the schools, maybe wasn't a great idea. But I just want to talk about transgender folks, first of all. One thing I want to make sure we understand, and please don't think that I am in any way patronizing my audience, because that is not my intent. However, having done quite a lot of work around LGBTQ issues over the course of my career, I have found out that unless people have a particular reason to be well-informed on these subjects, and that being either they themselves are gender fluid, they don't conform to the binary gender system that most of us think is correct, or they have a family member or close friend, etc. For most people, it's been my experience that if none of these apply to you, then you may really not know much about the issue. And there are so many things to know about in our complex world that doesn't mean that doesn't say anything bad about you. It just says you have not had an opportunity. So not my intent to talk down, just my intent to provide some information. Most of us think of gender identity as gender as pretty simple. You're either a male or a female. And the assumption is that what you are experiencing inside, how you think of yourself, what your brain tells yourself you are, who you are, is going to conform to what your body looks like externally. That is the case for the vast majority of people. We are born, the doctor, midwife, whomever, takes a look between our legs and on the basis of what's seen there says it's a boy or it's a girl. And we accept that and we carry on as though that's exactly who we're dealing with. And then, of course, along with that goes all the gender expectations and gender norms and all the other things that are social constructs and that vary by culture. So we know they are not biologically mandated. Biology plays a role, of course. Biology has an influence, but so do cultural expectations and social norms. So for those folks whose bodies do not really match who they experience themselves to be, obviously this can be very confusing and very painful. And what unfortunately happens a lot is that families reject or treat badly the child who is not conforming to gender expectations. And certainly, unfortunately, especially for boys, I've just heard too many stories from trans females, so women who were born biologically identified as male, but who in themselves and their own heart and brain felt themselves to be female, a lot of violence perpetrated against them as they were growing up for not acting like a boy, not being a little man. And unfortunately, that violence frequently coming from within the family, as well as the rejection and the teasing and being ostracized by peers. We have to make sure that we understand that a transgender individual is not a cross-dresser. Cross-dressers are people that like to dress in the clothing of the opposite gender. And yes, our clothing is still quite gendered these days. Women have a lot more latitude than we used to. 100 years ago, we could be arrested for wearing slacks. Not the case anymore. We can wear dresses, skirts, pants, whatever. Things are not nearly as permissive for men. A guy who wears a skirt's gonna have a hard time out on the street. But anyway, cross-dressing means that a person likes to put on the attire of the opposite gender. Oftentimes, this is related to sexual pleasure. The vast majority of cross-dressers are male. The vast majority of male cross-dressers are straight, contrary to popular mythology. They are straight men. And a very large percentage of the straight men who like to cross-dress are married. And it is not at all uncommon for their wives to not only know about and accept the cross-dressing, but to participate. There are conventions of folks who are cross-dressers, and oftentimes spouses are in attendance with them. You will hear of husbands and wives who like to go shopping for women's clothes together, some for him, some for her. So cross-dressing is a completely separate entity. It is a person who is transgender is not somebody who just likes to dress up in the opposite sex clothes. That's a cross-dresser. There are also people who are just gender fluid, who don't necessarily consider themselves or don't like to be restricted to, I am a man or I am a woman. People who, well, and we just lost Prince. I don't know that he really identified this way, but there was a song where he said, I'm not a woman, I am not a man, I am something you cannot understand. He certainly, in his outward appearance, pushed boundaries and was fearless in sporting an androgynous look his entire career. But there are people who feel, you know, I'm neither man nor woman. And I don't want to be categorized as such. And I don't want to have to conform. I don't feel myself to be myself if I am forced to conform to gender expectations. A person who is a transgender is a person who basically identifies with the gender that is opposite to what their body is telling the outside world they are. Now, we don't really know how many Americans identify as transgender. Gary Gates, an LGBT demographer at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law's Williams Institute, came up with the most frequently cited and yet still limited estimates of the country's transgender population. He claims about 700,000 or about 0.3% of adults. And that figure comes from two separate surveys, one that was conducted in Massachusetts 2007 and 2009, and the other in California in 2003. But, again, that's limited. The U.S. Census, which is, of course, asks for your gender, only allows two responses, male or female. There is no option for transgender folks, and therefore there is no way to really get an accurate count. This is a lot like race used to be on the census. I can't remember now which census it was changed on. It might have been 2000, but I'm kind of blanking on that. But previously, in responding to the question about race on the U.S. Census, it was, you know, check one. And for a lot of people, myself included, I'm biracial, check one doesn't work for me. So, in essence, we were forced into a choice that did not reflect who we truly are. And I see this as being very, very much the same. If you're only given two options, male or female, and you know that doesn't necessarily reflect, we're not going to have we're not going to be able to get a good count of how many people are transgender. When you can't quantify the statistics of a group, it's pretty difficult to really understand the challenges. It's pretty difficult to lobby for programs, to lobby for federal funding, because it's like you're going in there asking without evidence. What we do know, there are some things that we know, and it comes from a study that was called Injustice at Every Turn. It was a survey that was conducted by the National Center for Transgender Equality and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force in 2008. So again, the study is called Injustice at Every Turn. And it was the largest survey to date, and it only had 6,450 participants. My understanding is that these same researchers are now working on another survey to be done with a larger pool, and that's going to be published shortly. We do know that transgender people face a much higher suicide risk. Based on the Injustice at Every Turn study, 41% of transgender people surveyed had attempted suicide. 41%. That's compared with just 1.6% of the general population. The risk of attempting suicide increased for those who reported being bullied, being sexually assaulted, losing their job. And a study found that 78% of transgender respondents who had endured physical or sexual violence at school had attempted suicide. We also know that poverty is a huge problem in the trans community. Transgender respondents were nearly four times more likely to have a household income of less than $10,000 compared to the general population. They were unemployed at twice the rate of the general population, roughly between 10 and 14% throughout 2008, the year the survey was conducted. Keep in mind that in most places in the United States, it is perfectly legal to fire somebody, not hire them in the first place, not promote them. In other words, to discriminate against them in employment, and it's legal. There is no protection. There's no protection at the federal level. I don't think there are any states. There are some municipalities and some counties. I do not think that there's any states. And if someone knows better, call me and correct me, please. But I don't think that there are any states that prohibit discrimination against trans people. So it makes sense that the unemployment rate, and I have personally have known quite a number of people who lost their jobs when they began to transition, even if they went and spoke to the employer, et cetera, et cetera. One-fifth of survey respondents said that they had been homeless at some point, and more than half reported they were harassed at a homeless shelter by residents and staff. Nearly one-third said they were turned away altogether, and nearly a quarter said they were sexually assaulted. The trans community reports much higher rates of housing discrimination. The Department of Housing and Urban Development published a report showing evidence that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals and their families are being arbitrarily excluded from some housing opportunities in the private sector. 11% of respondents reported having been evicted due to bias, and 19% reported becoming homeless. Healthcare discrimination is also a problem. A 2010 survey by the National Center for Transgender Equality and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force found most transgender respondents receive some kind of transition-related medical care. However, 19% said they had been refused care due to their gender status, with higher numbers among people of color. 28% said they had been harassed in a medical setting, and half said they had to teach their medical providers about transgender care. 25% of transgender recipients reported losing a job because they did not conform to gender norms, and a staggering 90% said they had faced some form of transgender-based discrimination. Transgender people still can't technically serve in the military. They're barred from entering military service by medical regulations. Potential service members must undergo a physical exam before joining. They can be rejected for evidence of genital surgery. Still, about 15,000 transgender people are currently serving in the military, according to research from the Williams Institute. So, just by whatever you want to call it, because we don't really understand yet, very likely there is something that happens hormonally in utero that accounts for the transgender experience. We do not, however, know definitively. Very likely, though, it is deeply rooted in biology, meaning that once again, we are discriminating against people, perpetrating violence against people who are who they are and have been from birth. This really isn't any different than discrimination on the basis of gender or race, honestly, because it's something that a person does not choose. It is something that they cannot readily change. And trans folks will tell you of struggling very, very hard to conform to the gender that the world sees them as. And many trans folks are very, very, very successful at pretending to be what they're not. They've learned it very, very well and basically have the world fooled. But it comes at a huge cost to themselves psychologically and emotionally, and at a huge cost to their relationships with other people. When you have to be dishonest, feel that you must be dishonest about something as essential to your being as whether you feel you are a man or a woman, or neither, as may be the case. When you feel you can't be honest about that, that's huge, and that puts a significant roadblock to authentic and meaningful relationships with other people. That may very well be what a person feels they have to do to survive, and that's very understandable. But it shouldn't be that way. I found a really interesting kind of audio, an article and audio clip that I wanted to share with you. And oh, it looks like I have lost track of that. No, wait a minute. Here it is. I think I've got it. Nope, maybe I don't. Well, that's a drag. I really wanted to play this for you. Well, maybe I will come to that later. I can't seem to get it to work right now. Again, though, what I think is missing, I think that the president seems to be moving towards making trans issues a signature piece of his legacy as president. That seems to be what he's trying to do, and I think that that is great. But I also think that maybe things could have been done differently. I have been working as a teaching assistant at an Urbana elementary school. I asked one of the teachers whether there had been any conversation about this, and she wasn't aware of any. But I can well imagine how unprepared most teachers would feel to cope with this issue. And for some reason, you know, the bathroom seems to be the big issue, and I've never been able to understand why. I can pretty much guarantee you, if you're an adult and you have used public washrooms over the course of your adult life, you have been in a public restroom with a trans person and you just didn't know it. The trans person is in that bathroom with you because that is the gender they identify with, and that is what makes them the most comfortable. If a trans woman goes into a woman's restroom, she is not in there as a disguised man hoping to peek at the other women that are in there. That is, and the fact that people even say that, I'm sorry, is just ignorant. That's not the case. And to think that men are going to dress up in women's clothing so they can sneak into women's bathrooms, again, is ludicrous. Very few men of any stripe, but men who want to do that, that just makes no sense, because they have to be in public. First of all, they have to be convincing. And I think that the average guy who just wants to go peek at women in a bathroom is not going to pass very well in his efforts to dress as a convincing woman. But even if he can, he has to have the confidence to walk around in public dressed up as a woman in order to accomplish sneaking into a bathroom. And honestly, I have to say, what you're going to see in a woman's bathroom, anything that you're going to see in a woman's bathroom, you can find online. Whatever you're into, you can find it online. You can find video of every single act that can take place in a woman's bathroom. I guarantee you there's a niche site that will allow you to go do that. And I honestly believe that it's just a straw man being put up, that the argument that men are going to dress up in women's clothing so they can go into women's bathrooms and peek or assault or do whatever it is. The bathroom has always been the big bugaboo, and it really makes no sense. Now, when we start talking about schools, school is difficult enough for children that are different in any way. In any way. Imagine how difficult it is for a trans child. And even if the family is very supportive, out in the rest of the world, things can be very difficult. School should be a safe space for all children. Every child should feel safe at school. And for a trans child to have to go into the bathroom that conforms with how they look on the outside, but not who they are on the inside, is traumatizing. Again, I don't think we're going to have, well, elementary school kids and even middle school kids, I don't think this would even occur to them. High school boys, I can imagine joking around with each other and saying, hey, let's dress up and we can go in the girls' locker room. But the teachers and the staff and the administrators at that school are going to know better. Generally speaking, a child or a teen who is trans, a sensitive adult is going to have realized that they're different, that they don't conform to the gender norms and gender expectations around appearance that their peers do. And there's going to be a sense, I think, certainly there is going to be a good sense that a heterosexual, fully identified male teenager who suddenly comes to school in girls' clothing and says, I want to use the girls' locker room, I strongly suspect and would hope that any teacher or administrator worth his or her salt would question that and have a conversation with that student and with the parents and et cetera. I understand, and this is why I think the education piece is so important. There are all apparently, as I mentioned earlier, demonstrations being held by high school students and a concern being expressed by high school girls and their parents about just this sort of thing happening. And I think had the proper education been done, you know, I feel that rolling this out would have been great then to have rolled out to, at a minimum, if cost prohibitive, perhaps, to have speakers come in and do an assembly at every public school in the United States. But at a minimum, send out to all administrators the real information about trans identity, the myths, the facts, and educate the administration, who can then in turn educate the teachers, who can then in turn have age-appropriate conversations with students. And it appears that none of that happened, so this was just kind of sprung on people, and I think this sort of hysterical response maybe would not have been completely averted, because there are people who are willfully ignorant and frankly hateful. And we don't like you if you're different. And now you're asking for special stuff. That's always the ridiculous phrase. Why should they get special consideration when it's not? It's just basic human consideration. But yes, there's always going to be that minority of the population that, you know, damn the facts. This is wrong. This is bad. This is sinful. This is yada, yada, yada. But I also think that there are plenty of people who just don't know, who don't have the information, who are unaware, and if they were given the information, could be sensible about it. Okay, let me see. I'm going to try one more time to see if I can pull up this audio piece that I wanted to do. So this is an article by broadcast journalist Charlotte Robinson, and it's about Dina K. Rose, who wrote a memoir called Some Days Are Diamonds. Dina K. Rose is a writer and musician, and Some Days Are Diamonds chronicles Dina's life as a Nashville songwriter and her struggle to transition during a time when the term transgender didn't really exist. She recounts her times with Nashville legends. She wrote many, many, many songs, hit songs, for some of the biggest names in country music. But when she wrote them, everybody thought she was a man. In the 70s, she started writing songs that were pioneering in that they were addressing LGBT issues, but really, most people had no idea that these were in any way related to LGBT issues. She said that these songs were her way of coming out to the world while not having to visually come out for fear of the shame, the disappointment, the hurt it might cause her family. So this is a clip of Charlotte Robinson interviewing Dina K. Rose, and I'm going to play that for you now.
Dina K. Rose is here to talk about her new book, Some Days Are Diamonds, and give us her spin on her LGBT issues. Hi, Dina.
Hi, Charlotte. How are you, dear?
Fine. How are you?
I'm so good, I'm suspicious. I'm really good.
Tell us about your memoir, Some Days Are Diamonds.
Well, it's from a song I wrote. I wrote a song back in, I don't know, years ago in the last century called Some Days Are Diamonds, Some Days Are Stones. And it was recorded by John Denver. It was the last big hit that he had before he passed away. It's been recorded by a lot of people. Julie Andrews recorded it, Mary Poppins, you know. Bobby Bear recorded it. It's been recorded in English, French, Polish, Norwegian. It's been a hit in Australia. It's a well-known song. It's been a phrase that people have liked, but they don't know where it came from. What I was thinking about, I wasn't struggling with being transgender. I knew I was. I was struggling with what to do about it. And I felt that I had built up this following in the music business and a career, and that I would lose it all if I came out, which I'm pretty sure I would have. So I would change back and forth. One day I would be feminine and able to express that. The next day I would have to be male and have to express that. And that's what the song is about. It's the changing back and forth. The diamond is the feminine kind of image, and the stone is, of course, the male. So it's some days are diamonds, some days are stone. Sometimes the hard times won't leave me alone. Sometimes the cold winds blow a chill in my bones. Some days are diamonds, some days are stone. And people didn't know. People use it for everything. I mean, people have told me different stories about what it meant to them, you know, and they're all different. So it's kind of a an impressionistic song that people can kind of fill it in however they want, however it matters in their life. But what it meant to me was the changing back and forth. Now, Julie Andrews didn't know when she sang that line that she was talking about a transgender woman in Nashville. And I wanted to tell people that even a hillbilly cowboy from Missouri out in the country can be transgender and have no control over it. People say it's a choice. It's not a choice. Absolutely not a choice. I used to pray that I was not. And so anyway, I wanted to express that it affects everyone. It's not somebody in a big city. It's not somebody in a certain economic class. Not somebody in a certain anything. It's all of us. It is a real thing. It's not a whim. It's all of that. And that's what I wanted to get in my book and use Some Days Are Diamonds as the metaphor and the literal feeling of the book. That's what it is, and that's why it's called Some Days Are Diamonds.
What was your inspiration for writing it?
Too many times I've seen the impression that we were incapacitated with being transgender until we transitioned, that our lives were just empty, you know, hidden away in some shuttered castle somewhere in the woods, and we couldn't do anything. And that's not true. There are people who had achievements before they transitioned. And those people that were coming out, Caitlyn Jenner for sure, you know, the Wachowski sisters, Kristen Beck is someone that I kind of know. And, you know, they're people that claimed their achievements before they transitioned. And so it just became a point of, oh, by the way, I'm transgender. So that's what I wanted to say, that we weren't just sitting around. I've won awards. I've had songs recorded by Johnny Cash. I've had songs recorded by Burt Reynolds. Tons of people, 200 or 300 songs. You know, I was able to function before that, and I want to claim that now, because too often we didn't know people until they had transitioned. We only knew them as being transgender. They had a life before that. I wanted people to know that, good or bad, whatever.
What do you hope to accomplish with your work?
First of all, I want to do it for my community, you know. I want to claim my little part of being transgender and the struggle with it. I'm a mature lady. I won't tell you how old I am, but I am an older woman. I am a senior citizen. And I struggled with this in a time when we didn't even have the word. In fact, there wasn't any word until Christine Jorgensen, and then it was sex change. You had a sex change, and nobody knew that. She, in later life, I've read that she did not claim being transgender. She did not change her sex. She changed her gender. And so, you know, there was nothing to call it. We didn't know there was anyone else. There's a great song by Barry Manilow called All the Time. And it says, all the time I thought there's only me, crazy in a way that only I could be. And I wish I'd have written that, and maybe I will. But that's exactly how I felt in that time, that there wasn't anybody else. But I want people my age to know that I was there too, girls. We just didn't know about each other.
What is your personal commitment to LGBT civil rights?
There's a group called Gender Justice Nevada that really does some good work. And then I always perform every year on the Transgender Week of Empowerment. It's really what we're calling it now, which is in November, the Transgender Day of Remembrance is part of that. And then there's the visibility in the springtime that we do. I work a lot at the Southern Nevada LGBT Center. So I'm going to work for them. I'm working for Lambda next month. They're having a little luncheon that I'm going to play for and talk to them and do some new songs and stuff. And I just love those things because I can stand up and say, look, Johnny Cash didn't know that I would look like this. But he knew that my soul was like this. So I want to express that.
What would you like to see happen for LGBT equality in the next few years?
It would be really nice if we didn't have to say she is a transgender musician. It would be just nice to say she's a musician. And I think someday that will happen. But all these people who need some kind of big cardboard fear in order to raise their money, I think that is a real injustice to humanity. My family was very, very religious. That was part of the problem of me being so odd. And they would get their news of the world and life from one source, which would be whatever church they were in. And this is only my personal experience. It's the same group of people talking about transgender people going to whatever bathrooms and everything like that. And that is just a paper tiger. It is just a solution to something that doesn't have a problem. I just think it's going to do real harm to humanity, not only to LGBT people. But this is just not right. It's just not right. And it gives permission to... I've read these stories lately on the Internet about people who have appointed themselves bathroom police, that they have gone into the bathroom after people that they thought were using the wrong one. And most often, they were wrong. It was a person using the right bathroom, but they have carte blanche to go out and pick on other people. It just breaks my heart. We're just like a nice, quiet little bunch of people. If you knew us, you wouldn't mind at all. And everybody's been in the bathroom with a transgender person. They probably don't know it if they haven't. They probably don't know it. I think it's going to be resolved sooner than maybe the bathroom part, sooner than we expect, but it's going to linger for a while. You know, the way they are boycotting Mississippi and North Carolina, the people who are passing these actual laws to discriminate against a group of people. I mean, you couldn't do that with anyone else, but they used to. When I first went to the South, they had white-only water fountains and colored-only bathrooms. And nobody thought anything about it. That's the thing we should do because, you know, that's what they've told us is in the Bible. And so I think the transgender people are just next in line. When they needed somebody to pick on, it was us. But it's going to get resolved because too many of us are out there as very good examples of wonderful human beings. We're really just really nice people. And I think it's going to backfire a little bit, but that's our cause du jour, I guess, just for today.
LGBTQ teens are 4 times more likely to attempt suicide than their heterosexual peers, and we continue to have numerous teens taking their own lives after facing bullying incidents. What advice would you have for these kids?
That's another heartbreaker. There are a lot of resources now. It's just knowing about them and being able to contact them. If somebody is holding you back, holding you down, not accepting you, it's hard for you to go out and find someone who is accepting. You know, if you're a 14-year-old kid and you have to live with your parents, you don't have your own resources and all that, even if you know about some kind of help somewhere, some shelter, it's hard to get to it because your people that are holding you back know about it. And I think that's why, I'm sorry to say, that's why a lot of kids see that there's only one way out. And that is just, oh, it's just heartbreaking, especially in these times when you could do something about it.
How can people get information about Some Days Are Diamonds?
The book is an Amazon book, and it's a Kindle book, and I hope that people get something from it. I just want them to know that we're all in the same boat. We may have come on different ships to get where we are, but we're all in the same boat now.
Do you have a favorite quote or mantra to get you through difficult times?
I have a new song, and it's called We Will Not Turn Away From You. And it begins, for the masculine women, for the feminine men, for all the boys and girls who feel they never fit in. Beyond the whispers and the stares, just know there is someone who cares. And we will not turn away from you, no matter what they put you through. When the sea is stormy and there seems no way across, when you're in the lost and found and no one knows you're lost, there will be a light shining through, and we will not turn away from you. That is based on bullying and on trans people who are not accepted, especially. It's my group. And I hope the words say something to everyone, certainly to the people who are struggling with it, who see it as a problem.
Dina Kay.
And I think those are beautiful words from Dina K. Rose. And I think that that's something that it would be great if we could all live by. Let's, educate ourselves about folks who are different from us. Talk to them, learn from them. I personally have found trans folks to be extremely interesting to talk with because they are able to shine a light on, or maybe even more so, hold a mirror up to us in terms of what are the gender norms, expectations that are still extremely strong in our culture. When someone has lived as both a man and a woman, that person is able to share in a way that the rest of us can't. To actually have lived both experiences, to have lived both genders, I think is it's a great gift if that person is willing to share with us what those experiences were like. I know, for example, a person who lived the majority of her life as a man, and then in kind of early midlife decided that she just didn't want to pretend anymore. She had spent too much time being depressed and too much time feeling like an inauthentic being and wanted to be authentic, and so transitioned and found that the world was completely different for her in terms of people taking her seriously, people listening in the first place. She had been accustomed as a man in meetings, for example, to speak and be heard. And now she was finding trying to speak and being talked over, interrupted, talked down, not being heard. And it was quite a shocking experience. You know, to observe such things happening is one thing. To experience it for oneself is quite another. And I think that trans people are in the unique position to hold that mirror up to us and show us how firmly we're still holding on to pretty rigid gender expectations. And we know this by we still have different colors of clothing for baby boys and baby girls. We still have the boys' aisle of toys at Toys R Us or whatever your local toy merchandiser is, you know, separate toys for boys and girls. And it's very interesting to hear children themselves, you know, they've absorbed these lessons from us about what's okay and what's not okay, and they will enforce those with each other. So recently at school, a little boy said he really likes My Little Ponies, and My Little Pony, I should say, the toy in the TV show, and a couple of other boys immediately jumped up that couldn't happen, that shouldn't happen. And then one of the other adults said there's actually a group that refers to themselves as Pobros, Pony Brothers, boys that enjoy My Little Pony. And I'm certainly not suggesting that we haven't made progress, because we most certainly have, but we still have a long way to go. And especially when it comes to keeping our children safe, protecting our children, children that feel they don't have any other option but to die, that's a failure on the part of all of us adults that are in that child's life and in society in general. There's something wrong. There's something very wrong with that picture. We should be about 5 minutes away from our call-in guest, Howard Harrison. He is, again, author of the book called Now They Make It Legal, Reflections of an Aging Baby Boomer. A fun read, interesting, funny, and I'm looking forward to having Mr. Harrison call in, and we'll talk about his book and some other issues. What I want to do in the few moments leading up to our telephone conversation, I'm going to change topics and I'm going to switch over to the current primary campaigns that are taking place. And this is a column by a Canadian. He is an actor, a writer, a comic, and his name is Neil Crone. And this is a column called America, Have You Lost Your Mind? Just wanted to give you sort of a little bit of an opinion from our neighbors to the north. He is not alone in what he's saying. So I'm just going to read this. Dear America, hi, it's Canada. Just thought I'd drop you a line to catch up. I know we haven't corresponded in a while, and I just wanted to check in and make sure you hadn't, you know, completely lost your mind. Because golly, I have to tell you, it sure looks that way from here. We're all pretty darn worried about you up here, pal. You don't seem at all yourself lately. For starters, I know you're only 240 years old, but you might want to think about setting up an eye exam. You seem to be losing your vision. And I've never seen you so grumpy. Is this some kind of weird middle-age crisis or something? And what's with all that hate? I mean, don't take this the wrong way, pal, but have you been tested for dementia? You're like a different guy all of a sudden. Oh, and I think that might be our call-in guest. I'm going to take this. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling in for my 7 o'clock interview.
Is this Howard Harrison?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, great. Great. Thank you very much for calling in. I'm going to read a little bit of an introduction and then ask you to add anything you might want to add about yourself, and then we'll get into the conversation.
All right.
Howard Harrison is an award-winning professional journalist and an unapologetic baby boomer. I lived during some of the most impactful and turbulent times of American history, he says. As baby boomers, we introduced people to new music and were the first to experience TV. More importantly, we contributed to the civil rights movement and the questioning of war and our institutions, which resulted in a lot of political upheaval, literally changing the face of America. That political turbulence in the 60s and 70s, according to Harrison, has similarities to what we are seeing today. For the first time since then, he claims, we are seeing young people take on a passionate interest in politics. In his new book, Now They Make It Legal, Reflections of an Aging Baby Boomer, Harrison talks about the frustration of young people over the Vietnam War. Quote, the divisiveness back then had to do with young people protesting a war on the other side of the globe that they didn't want to be involuntarily drafted to fight and die in. While different than today, it's good to see young people out there attending political rallies with protest signs, almost enough to make some of us baby boomers wax nostalgic. And Howard, I did read your book. I found it very engaging and entertaining.
Thank you.
I am at the tail end of the boomer generation, but I had sisters 7 and 10 years older than myself.
Oh, me too.
And I found that commonality very interesting. So
yeah.
Meaning that we were kind of tuned into things that maybe our peers weren't because of our older siblings.
Exactly.
So even though I was born kind of at the tail end, I was aware of a lot of things going on.
Uh-huh.
So tell us a little bit more, whatever else you'd like to tell us about yourself, please.
Well, as far as myself, I mean, I've been a professional writer my whole life, but this is my first bylined book. I've ghostwritten books. I've been an executive speech writer. But this is my first bylined book title, so I'm excited about that.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. And we've been getting some real good feedback so far. Obviously, it was a lot of fun to do because it's part memoir. It certainly isn't all memoir. I mean, who would want to read my memoirs? But it's part memoir. I'm kind of the vehicle that takes the reader through the baby boom generation, through select stories that basically revolve around key events or happenings during those couple of decades. So, I'll add that.
And who, I'm not going to ask you that. Never mind. I'm going to back off of that question because that would be potentially compromising.
I have no idea what you're going to ask.
I'll
trust your judgment.
I'll keep it to myself. I found it really great because there were certain things that I had not even remembered. Certain toys, certain food, certain things that just had escaped my memory. And then I was like, oh, yeah, I remember those. The kid down the street had one of those.
Did you remember King Zor? Did anyone you know have King Zor? You're probably too young, but...
No, I was not familiar with that at all.
Oh, okay. Well, as I describe, and people will find this hard to believe, but this was a toy on the market for little kids, and it came with a dart. It was a plastic dinosaur, ran on batteries, and you turned it on, and it started kind of moving around and grumbling, and it came with a dart gun, and you would shoot a dart at its tail, and then it would turn around and shoot a projectile at you from his mouth. And this was legal back then. The following year, they came up with the next version, which was Robot Commando. Exactly the same thing, but a robot instead of a dinosaur, and the projectile came out of his head instead of his mouth. Otherwise, the same thing. And these were the kind of toys we played with. You know, parents were not as protective back then. I was listening to your show just a scad bit earlier. I heard the tail end of you saying something about we need to protect our kids. Well, you know, toys like this did not protect our kids, but somehow some of us have lived to tell about it. So I tell some of these stories in the book.
I do, however, remember jarts, though, which were
lawn darts
that had the very pointy end on them. And okay. I also remember clackers.
I don't remember.
Do you remember those? Clackers were... There was a ring that went around one's ankle. There were two strings that were attached to the ring. At the end of those strings were really, really, really hard glass balls. And the point of the game was, it was actually a lot of fun.
Oh, those balls that go back and forth?
Yeah, and you would jump, and jump and jump, and then, like, get these things spinning around your, you know. So it was a coordination. It was a great thing. However, those balls would fly off and conk children in the head, and they were so hard, they were knocking kids out. I think those were actually recalled, but I didn't give up my pair. I had them, and I loved them.
Now, do you remember when Mr. Potato Head required an actual potato?
I do not. My Mr. Potato Head was the plastic potato.
I had Mr. Potato Head at the age of maybe 4, because I remember we were in an old house. I lived in our old house till I was 5, so I might have been 3 or 4. And you just got the facial features that you'd stuck into the potato, but you needed an actual potato. I think it may have come with like a styrofoam potato, but you were supposed to use a real potato. And you know, you'd work on the face and you get the face, and then you know, during the week, you know, things are starting to grow out of the potato, you know, and your mother makes you throw it out, and you know, you have to get a new potato. But you needed a real potato back then.
Could I have used a rutabaga?
You probably could have, but
yes.
Who would have thought of that? I wouldn't have, as a little kid. It had to be a potato.
Or because it's otherwise and then they also came out with Mrs. Potato Head. I don't know if you remember that.
That was the funniest line in Toy Story at the very end when he's wishing for his Christmas present. Mr. Potato Head's wishing for the Christmas present, and he's like, Mrs. Potato Head.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, they didn't have Mrs. Potato Head when I was younger.
So I was hoping that you would share your thoughts on what you see as the similarities and the differences between the political and social upheavals that we saw in the 60s and 70s and what we are seeing now with the 2016 election.
It's interesting because this is the first election I remember, and maybe there were some while I was married, raising kids, and I wasn't paying attention. But it's the first one where I've seen young people with protest signs and a lot of them behind a very liberal agenda. And that does, you know, reflect back to the late 60s, early 70s when I first became politically aware. But I got to tell you, the circumstances are so completely different that to me there's far more differences than similarities. I mean, back then, as you and your listeners may well know, but back then the big controversy was the Vietnam War.
Yes.
And more than the war, it was the draft.
Yes.
And if you can picture, you know, being right out of high school, and really if your parents couldn't send you to college, you had a very good chance of being drafted to fight in this war in a country on the other side of the globe. You'd never even heard of it. You felt it was their war, but you were forced to fight in it. And the average age of these kids being drafted was 19 years old. World War II, the average age of the American soldiers was 26.
Yes.
So this really hit close to home to young people then. And that's what, and it wasn't a controversy by party. You know, the Democrats were the ones that had escalated the war, yet no one was looking really, young people weren't looking to Nixon as their savior. They were looking to someone else in the Democratic Party, and they started rallying around RFK. And then Bobby got assassinated.
Yes.
Right after he won the California primary, and that threw things into turmoil. The convention, you had militia, beaten heads of war protesters who were simply protesting. Fortunately, I don't see that level of violence in this campaign, and I also don't see any issues that would warrant such a level of violence in this campaign. So fortunately, I think that's a huge difference. You know, it's good to see peaceful protests, and it's good to see people express their views. Let's keep it nonviolent, and let's just keep the rhetoric a little less hateful, too, is something I'd like to see.
Well, and I would agree that we have not seen the mass violence, but we've seen, if not an encouragement of violence from the podium, and I'm referring to Trump, we've certainly seen approval of individual acts of violence. And that I have found to be pretty scary.
Yeah, and that's really unfortunate when, again, you consider that the issues that people are passionate about really don't warrant that kind of response. You know, I think some of it, and I don't want to blame young people because I used to be one, number one. And number two, you know, I have kids in their 20s, and I think young people are smarter than we ever were. But I also think a lot of them are getting politically involved for the first time, and they're letting their passions kind of come through in ways that, you know, we may find unconventional and certainly don't condone. But, you know, we were all young once. You know, again, I don't pardon it. I don't condone it. But we were all young once. I know my first year on campus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, my first week on campus was when Ford pardoned Nixon. And there was a big riot on campus, and cars were turned over, and somebody burned an American flag on the steps of the Capitol. My roommate grabbed the remnant of the American flag, and we put it on our wall, and were proud when it was mentioned in Time magazine that a flag was burned, and we pointed to it. I mean, these were immature acts of people who were 18 years old, and I think some of the violence is coming from that element, except today's version. I really hope it doesn't go any farther than it has. And yeah, the candidates, certainly one in particular, can take more of a leadership role. I really don't understand the reluctance to do that.
Well, and it seems that that Sanders is really the candidate that has energized young voters. The oldest candidate is the one that has really energized the young voters, because he is speaking to issues that impact them very directly. They are suffering in ways that we did not at that age.
Yeah, I think I think they see their opportunities as more limited than perhaps we did.
And I think realistically so.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they're kind of lost, you know. The system's complicated. Everything gets more complicated every day, and people want to feel like they're represented. And, you know, I think the Sanders and some of the Trump people, too, although not the same young crowd that we're talking about, but people feel disenfranchised. You know, it's interesting that the passion is coming from the outsiders. It reminds me, again, here's a baby boom reference, but one of my favorite movies is The Graduate, mm-hmm. and it reminds me of the scene where Dustin Hoffman is trying to move into this rooming house in Berkeley, very radical campus, and Norman Fell is like the caretaker, and he's leading him up the stairs. He goes, "You're not one of those outside agitators, are you? I hate those outside agitators." Well, you know, Trump and Sanders both have a lot of outside agitators kind of as part of their following.
Right,
and
yeah.
I think you're seeing some of that stuff.
So for you, you see that there's some of that same energy, some of that passion, very different issues between then and now.
Yeah, different issues and different circumstances. You know, we were, you know, in the 60s, a lot of it was the young people versus the old people, you know, us versus the parents. Again, it wasn't like Democrat versus Republican like it is today. That's what the great divide is today. It was the generation gap with us, you know. We looked at our parents just, you know, blindly support, you know, they always just supported, you know, any war that the United States went into. They thought, you know, long hair was ridiculous. They thought rock music was ridiculous. You know, so on a cultural, music, political, all these different fronts, drug use, all these different fronts, there seemed to be younger generation versus older generation was where the chasm was. Not so much Republican versus Democrat. But yeah, the young people with the passion, it just shows itself a little different today. But
I remember the phrase, never trust anybody over 30.
Over 30, right. Yeah. Now my son's about to turn 30. Hard to believe.
You know what? So is my daughter, one of my daughters. This summer she'll be 30 years old, and it kind of blows my mind.
Yeah. Now, is she politically involved at all or interested or motivated?
She is.
My kids are not.
She is, and she's a very adamant Sanders supporter.
Uh-huh.
And she pays attention to the issues, and she keeps herself informed. And she actually, since the time she was able to vote, she's always voted and exhorted her peers to vote. So she's pretty politically astute, I would say. And she makes Mama proud.
Now, is she prepared to support the Democratic ticket even if it's not Bernie, because it's most likely not going to be?
She says that she is, simply because Trump is a much worse, the specter of a president's Trump is unbearable.
Yeah, I think if people need to vote the lesser of two evils in their mind, it's still worth voting.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
I just think it's worth voting. You can't possibly not care. So, no, that's great to hear. That's great to hear.
So what is it about the two-party system that you object to?
Oh, God. I think it's just shown itself so clearly that it just drives people apart.
Mm-hmm.
I hardly know where to begin, but let's start with the fact that you're given two choices, okay? And this is a country that gets more diverse by the day. And you take these myriad of issues, unrelated issues, and there's hundreds of them, and you divide them into two buckets, just two buckets, social issues, national defense, moral issues, all kinds of things, economic issues. You get bucket A or bucket B. There's no way that can possibly represent even a fraction of the people's interests in the country. So and that's not the worst of it, though, because the two sides just unabashedly disparage each other with reckless abandon.
Mm-hmm.
So So if you identify as Democrat, you are hearing yourself being disparaged severely by half the country, basically, because about half the country votes one way, about half the country votes another way. So I don't have the answer here. I do know that our founding fathers, you know, the 70s Rat Pack, the 1770s I'm talking about,
yeah.
You know, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Ben Franklin, you know, their buddy Ben Franklin, yeah, the whole Rat Pack. Now, they, I think, had it right. Whoever got the most votes was president. Whoever got the second most votes was vice president. So at least you had most of the people that voted were, you know, they felt they were somehow represented. That's probably not realistic in this day and age, but what I'm saying is the way the system has evolved, it just drives people apart in a very unhealthy way. You know, we have barbecues and go out with friends and have family members that vote the other party than we do. And we're able to be civil. We're able to enjoy these people's company. But if you heard the political discourse, you would think we're all supposed to hate each other and that we're on the verge of a civil war. So, you know, I just think that the party and the winning at all costs has just become so important that it has driven people apart. We're way more alike than we are different, but you would never know it the way our political system operates. That's the problem I have with the two-party system, and I realize other parties can run, but realistically it's a two-party system, and I just don't think it's representative. And I think that's come through in this election because of the divisions within the parties. There are people that just don't seem represented by their party. Maybe we need a few more parties to represent people, and maybe we need to give those people a voice based on, you know, the number of people that vote for a certain ideology. I don't know. It would be nice to see people open up their thinking and try to find a better way to do this.
Well, and it's certainly something that occurs in other countries. Canada has, you know, many parties, although three of them at the national level, just three of them, I don't want to say matter, but really have a voice, if you will,
mm-hmm.
and very consistently. And I think that matters. And I'm not entirely sure why that can't happen here or why that hasn't happened here.
Yeah, I think that the culture, you know, their discourse is a little higher level,
yes.
You know, than ours has been reduced to here. And you know, I don't know what you do. You know, free speech means that, you know, whoever, you know, if somebody's popular and they bring it down to a certain level, well, that reflects the country, I guess. But, you know, the discourse in this race has gotten to, you know, when you're talking about people's wives, body parts and stature and gender and you know, come on. It's embarrassing, really. I'm sure there's other countries that just laugh at us over this stuff. And really, it's not funny. You know, I'm laughing because that's how I like to go through life. I want to enjoy myself,
right.
And I can be here that long. But, it, you know, it's really not funny. It's kind of sad.
I was actually just starting to read a piece that I'll finish when after you and I conclude, and it is in fact a Canadian columnist, and the article is entitled "America, Have You Lost Your Mind?"
Yeah.
And you know, it's kind of comedic, but it makes some very good points, and it's very clear that many other countries are looking at what's happening right now politically in the United States and just scratching their heads. And it's just kind of, we knew y'all were crazy. We didn't know y'all were this crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. They've known we were crazy for a while. They were laughing at the Monica Lewinsky thing. They've been laughing at the George W. They've been laughing. But yeah, I think they're laughing harder, maybe.
Yeah. And maybe actually afraid, really afraid for us.
In
a way that they weren't before.
Yeah, but you know what? It is. It's all going to be okay. It's all going to be okay. It really is. You know, I know people that are just freaked out over the prospect of one or the other candidates being in it, and I just try to tell them, you know, the gears move so slow that, you know, no matter how bad someone is, you know, we've survived some bad presidencies recently. So, and I'm not including the current one, but that's just my personal
Yeah.
But you know, we can survive a lot here.
And
so let's not panic. Let's be interested in it. Let's take it seriously. But come on, let's not jump off any ledges either, you know?
Oh, good. I'm glad you just talked me back from that. I was on the ledge here at WFT just a minute ago. So,
are you in a big building? Are you like on a high floor or something?
Yeah, we're on the first floor. So.
Oh, well then you're okay. Unless there's a moat around.
I probably wasn't going to be too terribly injured. Now, we mentioned Bernie Sanders, and I have here in the notes that you argued for Medicare for All before Bernie Sanders and that you do it better. Could you tell us about that, please?
Well, I don't know if I do it better or not, but I have been talking about this for a long time. I spent a lot of my career in the healthcare field. You know, I worked for a lot of hospitals and healthcare companies and written op-eds for CEOs on healthcare-related topics and things like that. And, you know, again, I don't think we should necessarily be a follower, but the fact that we are the only country in the world that leaves the payment of healthcare to private insurance companies whose shareholders demand they make a profit, and the fact, so when you couple that with the fact that we also pay the most for our healthcare,
mm-hmm.
and that our outcomes are really no better than middle of the pack, it makes you wonder why there are so many people that think that our system, our unique method of paying for healthcare, is better than everybody else's.
Right.
Okay, so the fact remains, yeah, of course, if you pay for healthcare out of your tax dollars, you're going to pay more in taxes. But just think how much we pay in insurance premiums these, you know, right now. Plus, if we're lucky enough to work for an employer that subsidizes our health care, I don't think those employers look forward to being in the health care business. I don't think, you know, a company that makes whatever, shoelaces, whatever, wants to be in the health care business. But we kind of force them to be because we force health care to be in the private sector. Because
yes.
Everything in the private sector is supposed to be better except for a few select things like national defense, police, fire. Otherwise, everything's supposed to be better in the private sector. Now, I agree with a lot of that, but I think when it comes to healthcare, you know, if you view it that way, you don't view healthcare as a right. I view healthcare as a right. Most countries view healthcare as a right. If someone's sick and dying, you don't let them die in the street. You take care of them. Well, there has to be a mechanism to pay for that besides just draining everybody else who does pay into the system.
Right.
You know, and here's another point, and I don't want to keep going on and on. I don't even know how much time we're supposed to have here. But, you know, us baby boomers are all getting old and retiring, and pretty soon we're all going to be on Medicare, which is social. Well, that is our socialized medicine system, Medicare. And pretty soon, and when you are in your last stages of life, you spend more on health care than the rest of your life combined.
Yes.
So when you think about it, Medicare pretty soon is going to be paying the lion's share of health care in this country anyway.
Yes.
Why not just let the young and healthy pay into the system? You get a Social Security card, you're covered. Pay into the system. Young people are going to pay in more than they're going to use, but when they get older, it'll balance out. I don't see, and I'm not an economist, so please don't flood my email with it, but I don't know. It seems to make sense to me. And again, if our system is so much better, how come no other industrialized country on the face of the earth would chuck their system for ours?
Absolutely.
There's got to be a reason.
And I do think when you look at our outcomes, our health outcomes are, I mean, our rate of infant mortality, I don't remember what the stat is now. I remember reading it not too long ago and being appalled.
It's no better than middle of the pack.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody thinks, oh, we have the best health. No, we don't.
No, we don't.
We just pay the most.
Yeah. And I bring up Canada again because I am a permanent resident of Canada but maintain my American citizenship. And having experienced the healthcare in Canada after living the majority of my life in the United States, I'm even more convinced than I was before. It works. It really does work.
We would never trade that system for ours.
No. You know what? And you had mentioned earlier about people having health insurance, and even if you have really great health insurance, if you end up with a very, very serious, chronic, debilitating illness, your insurance is not going to cover everything you need. I mean, that's just the reality of it.
Right. Plans differ. It's all so complicated. It doesn't have to. It doesn't have to be.
No, it does not. Yeah. And the people, I personally know a family where the husband has great insurance. He has a very, very, very serious illness. And despite having great insurance, their debt is mounting so fast that they can't see light at the end of the tunnel. And to my way of thinking, people who have worked all their lives, he no longer is capable of working. The wife is, so she continues to work very hard. You've worked all your life. You have insurance that's supposed to be great insurance, and yet you cannot keep up with the medical bills. Something's not working.
Right.
Something is not working.
Right, right. This is an area when it comes to people's health that really the country should take care of its citizens. Every other country does, and it's not wimpy, and it's not. It's just the right thing to do. You know, like that oatmeal guy with the big mustache. You say it's the right thing to do.
Oh, Wilford Brimley. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, we, from my understanding, the majority of Americans support it. So I'm not too sure.
So what are we waiting for?
Yeah,
right?
So what are we waiting for? Why is this not happening?
Well, the majority of Americans support legalizing pot, too. And by the time that happens, I'm going to be dead and buried and won't even be able to enjoy it. So, you know, like I said, the gears of change move very slowly in this country.
Now, I had as a guest back in March on this program a gentleman named Dan Lynn, and he's the National Director of Policy for Phoenix Botanicals. Phoenix Botanicals owns and operates dispensaries for medical marijuana. And the first dispensary in Champaign-Urbana, which is where we're located, opened just very recently. And he was able to provide just fascinating details about his own personal, he would not say, and nobody would ever say, that one person does something all on their own. But he did almost single-handedly fight for 10 years to get medical marijuana legal in the state of Illinois.
It shouldn't have been that hard.
No, and he can tell you stories about people whose suffering is greatly relieved by the use of marijuana, which is not addictive like opioids. Which looks like might have killed Prince, and by the way, and you know.
Oh yeah, I mean, compared to other pharmaceuticals, again,
yes.
I worked a lot in the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, my God, I can't believe we're comparing the things. I mean, it's crazy. It's really crazy. It's just it's historically based, and things are hard to change. And if they make no sense at all, they're still hard to change. If most of the people want it, it's still hard to change. It's just hard to change.
I was acquainted with a 40-plus year veteran of law enforcement who like most law enforcement officers, certainly enjoyed his beer. But he would say, if you had to outlaw something, you know, I know we tried, it didn't work, but really, what's the most dangerous? It's alcohol.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Far more police calls are alcohol related.
Absolutely.
And
I mean, it's ridiculous the amount of destruction caused between these two substances, and the wrong one is illegal. Not that I think, you know, alcohol should be illegal. I just think it should be legal, because otherwise you lose respect for the law itself, because it just doesn't make sense.
No, so, it doesn't. And historically, the reason it became illegal in the first place was based on racism. And so something that was not done for, it wasn't made illegal for any kind of scientific reasons. It was made illegal because people didn't like the Mexicans who were using it recreationally, and then didn't like the black jazz musicians who were using it recreationally. And it, you know, became a moral issue. And I find it just seems to me that that's really not the basis for deciding about something being legal or not. It ought not be. It shouldn't have been in the early 1900s. It certainly shouldn't be now. But
yeah. And when you compare it to alcohol or cigarettes, which you can, you know, walk into any liquor store and buy as much as you want, you know, even where pot is legal now, you know, there's severe restrictions on how much you can buy. And you know, I don't know. I don't live in these states, but I know there's restrictions on that. Maybe you have to register. You can only buy so much if you don't live in this, you know, all this stuff. Yet you can go into a liquor store and buy as much liquor as you want. You can buy curtains of cigarettes. But so even where it's legal now, it's just still kind of ridiculous how careful they are. That's why I say I don't know that I'm going to live to see the day when I can just, like, walk into a store and get some. You know, I'll probably be too old, but whatever. You know, I don't know when I'm going to see that day. It just takes so long. And I want to say this. You know, it's good to hear that the medicinal marijuana is now available for people who have illnesses and really need this, because it works better than anything else and it's safer than anything else. I'm glad to hear that, but there is a part of me that's against the medical marijuana, only because I don't. It feels like an interim step that's unnecessary. They did that during Prohibition with alcohol too. During Prohibition, some people could get it through prescription. It just seems like an unnecessary interim step. Willing to put up with it as long as it, you know, expands the accessibility of this for folks who want it and need it. But, you know, I still cannot figure out why it can't just be legalized, taxed, regulated, let states make money off it, let people stop getting busted for it, let people, you know, out of jails that sell it, and just, you know, put a lot of street gangs out of business and move on to more important things.
I agree with you. It doesn't make any sense. And it's one of the other places where looks like Canada is going to be well ahead of us.
Of course.
Canada's enforcement, well, and actually the laws as they're written are already more permissive, just in terms of, you know, how quantities that will get you in trouble, et cetera. But that was one of the issues that Trudeau ran on. And I've not been paying as much attention to what's happening in Canada since I've been down here in the States. But I'm hearing that this has been, in the last couple of months especially, just a really, really every night news item. And there's really not it does not appear to be a ton of opposition.
No, I think the people have spoken. You know, this country will probably be last, and Illinois will probably be last out of the states.
No, I think Indiana will hold out longer than Illinois will.
We'll see. It'll be an interesting race.
Yeah, a race.
When it gets down to it. Wasn't there an argument even here just recently about, you know, whether 10 ounces or 15 ounces should qualify for, you know, decriminalized versus, you know, felony? I mean, do the people argue, the legislators arguing this stuff, do they know how stupid this is? I mean,
I'm not sure that they do.
I don't think they do.
I don't think that they realize that a lot of Americans are just looking at it saying, are you kidding me? And we're electing you to deal with things that we find a lot more pressing in our lives than that.
Yeah.
But I think it all, I think it gets very much caught up in the old remnants of moralistic views of how people should behave and what they should do with their own bodies, and it clearly doesn't make any sense.
No, and political people, you know, that have to get elected, they're just so skittish on this issue because they're just afraid if they come out and talk about it as openly as we're talking about it, that they can't get elected. And I think they're afraid for nothing. I think they would find that people would find it refreshing. They would probably find, you know, look at how, you know, the people that do go for Donald Trump, so many of them just say, well, because he's a straight shooter, at least he's just a straight. Now, I don't happen to agree that he's a straight shooter, but a lot of people see him that way.
Right.
If some candidate would just tell the truth, just say what you feel, you know, act like a human being, I think they'd find it wouldn't be as politically destructive as they think it would be. You know, the party establishment would freak out, and then they wouldn't get their contributions and all that kind of, but come on, just be real, and you just might win in a landslide someday, you know?
Yeah, just for being honest.
Yeah.
What a thought, a politician being honest.
Yeah, what a concept.
Are there other things that stand out for you as a proud baby boomer? Things that stand out for you about our current social and political climate and where you think it's headed and what you hope to see. Well, we know that for one, you'd hope to see marijuana completely legalized before you shuffle off this earthly plane. Do you have any other just kind of thoughts, reflections, memories, anything that comes to mind as a baby boomer?
Well, you know, a memory I have is, you know, we were sometimes called, and my sister's more than me, but I was right on their coattails, you know, flower children. You know, peace and love was something that was promoted. It was promoted in the context we had this unpopular war going on, but it was also promoted in the context of, you know, our parents being so driven to make money and all this kind of stuff, of maybe taking a step back and appreciating some of the softer, yet possibly more meaningful things in life. And, you know I sound like an ex-hippie. Too bad. I would like to see people not be afraid to cry. I'd like to see people not be afraid to compromise, not think that by doing so you're weak. I think people should. I would just like to see people embrace some of that stuff we brought up in the peace and love generation in the hard world of today, you know, people to have the courage of that. And I'm encouraged by the Bernie Sanders folks, although, you know, it's a little contradictory when you hear about the violence, but I think most of those kids, their heart is in the right place.
I don't think that the violence that we've seen has really been coming out of the Bernie supporters.
Well, over the weekend, they said a few of them threw some chairs in Nevada because Bernie might have got, you know, screwed out of a couple of delegates or something like that.
Yeah,
you're right. No, I haven't seen anything widespread or serious, and I hope I don't.
Yeah.
I think those kids, their hearts are in the right place. I think they're idealistic, which is good to see, versus materialistic, which is good to see. And so I'd like to think that maybe we skipped a generation, but these young kids are kind of taking the baton that we kind of threw out there in the 60s and maybe bringing it into the modern world. I really would like to see the two parties, you know, if we're stuck with this system, just quit hating each other and encourage working together more. You're setting a horrible example for the electorate. These two parties are setting a horrible example for the electorate. You know, they shouldn't do that. They should encourage more. And, you know, I don't know the answer, but this, you asked me what I'd like to see. I'd like to see some of that flower child, peace and love sentiment that we brought forth in the 60s today. That's what I'd like to see.
I agree. I would like to see that too. And I also agree that it is exactly the opposite of weakness. I think that's true strength.
Yeah.
If I can express my own vulnerabilities and be sensitive to the vulnerabilities of others, I think it takes a tremendously strong person to really do that.
Yeah.
And I think that putting on a face of bravado, putting on a face of not caring, that to me is actually weakness. And
yeah.
We've got it backwards.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. I agree with you. So hopefully people will get a little braver.
So, Howard, could you please tell us where we can get your book and where we can be in touch with you and learn more about you?
Well, the book is easy to find because it's called Now They Make It Legal, accent on the now. Now They Make It Legal.
Mm-hmm.
A little sarcastic, a little bitterness in that title.
Yep.
And it can be found on a website called nowtheymakeitlegal.com.
So, okay, great.
Name of the book.com, nowtheymakeitlegal.com. You can also get it through Amazon or any of the other retail booksellers that sell books online. You can find it there. So,
okay.
Pretty easy to find.
Okay, and are there places to go to read other things that you have written?
There will be, because I am currently working on my second Byline book title, and it is going to be on this election.
Oh!
And it is practically writing itself, but I will certainly put my own spin on it. You can be sure of that. And I'm hoping to release that as quickly after this election wraps up as possible. So hopefully people will remember me and take a read, because it's going to be really good.
Oh, I think it's going to be fascinating. And yeah, writing itself,
it's writing.
There's certainly no lack of...
I just have to figure out how to get like 3,000 pages worth down to like 300 pages when it's done, because it's just taking up two file cabinets already. But that's a writer's dream, chiseling down and just using the best stuff.
So sure.
I'm really excited about it.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations on this book. And again, go to nowtheymakeitlegal.com to be able to get the book, Now They Make It Legal, Reflections of an Aging Baby Boomer. Howard Harrison, it has been my distinct pleasure to have you as a guest, and good luck with this book. Looking forward to the next one coming out after the election.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, great. Take care.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Howard Harrison, author of Now They Make It Legal, Reflections of an Aging Baby Boomer. And interesting conversation about the differences between the social and political movements of the 60s and 70s and this election. And I guess not surprisingly, next book is going to be about this election, and I look forward to reading that. I'm going to get back to this column that I was reading by Neil Crone, entitled America, Have You Lost Your Mind? And I'm not going to read it back from the beginning, but I am going to kind of back up a little bit. So this is Canada addressing the United States. We're all pretty darn worried about you up here, pal. You don't seem at all yourself lately. For starters, I know you're only 240 years old, but you might want to think about setting up an eye exam. You seem to be losing your vision. And I've never seen you so grumpy. Is this some kind of weird middle-aged crisis or something? And what's with all the hate? I mean, don't take this the wrong way, pal, but have you been tested for dementia? You're like a different guy all of a sudden. Maybe it's Alzheimer's. You know, your memory does seem pretty sketchy lately. You're telling me you have no recollection of all those immigrants who built you? All those people you welcomed with, how did you put it again? Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Man, I gotta tell you, pal, that was some inspired stuff. And that constitution of yours? Wow. You were on your game back then, dude. So what the hell exactly is going on these days? I don't know if you've noticed, but you've got a guy in the race for president who we wouldn't treat, sorry, who we wouldn't trust running a chip truck. For Americans not familiar with the term, by the way, chip truck, chip is fries. Chip truck is vendors, street vendors, who sell French fries and sandwiches and that kind of stuff. But they call it a chip truck there. So a guy who we wouldn't trust running a chip truck. I mean, he's nothing more than a bully with bad hair. And you're about to hand him the keys? Dude, you used to despise guys like him. Remember when we all got together and tuned up that German moron? You were awesome then. And the rest of us, well, we kind of looked up to you. Now, geez, I don't know. Look, we grew up together. I'm probably your best friend. Heck, our yards are right beside each other. And I understand we've had our ups and downs. I mean, I know you're still steamed about us burning your capital and handing you your ass at hockey every time you turn around. And our beer is way better than yours, and your healthcare system blows. But still, we're buds, right? Who totally had your back during that Iraq WMD snafu? So I'm telling you, as your friend, I love you, bro, but you're being a tool. You're better than this. Remember who you used to be, and come election day, fix it. Love and poutine, Canada. I just thought that was kind of an amusing and maybe not so amusing take on one Canadian's viewpoint, although I have to say it is my impression from speaking with folks and doing some reading that a lot of Canadians are feeling this way. They are, as are other countries around the world, as Mr. Harrison and I were just saying, are kind of looking at, wait a minute, the presumptive candidate for president of the Republican Party is a reality TV star who does not seem to have any actual ideas other than build a wall, which seems to be, you know, I'm going to build a wall and Mexico is going to pay for it. Oh, wait. And the other ideas, I think register all Muslims. Don't let any Muslims in the country, not even Muslims who are citizens but happen to be out of the country. We're not going to let them back in. Yada, yada, yada. It seems that the ideas that are being promoted and the potential policies that are going to come out of them just don't seem to make any sense. And I think rightfully so. Other people in other countries are scratching their heads and wondering what the heck happened. About Trump, I read, as many people did, the New York Times article that came out over the weekend that talked about Trump and his complicated, maybe even bizarre relationships with women, because on the one hand, he has entrusted major portions of his various businesses to women, even at a time back in the 80s, you know, when most other men were not doing anything of the sort. And yet at the same time, well, those same women that he was entrusting in positions of responsibility and power, he apparently would also comment on their bodies in the workplace, note that they were getting too fat, remind them that they should, eat less candy. And it's interesting to, in this article, even the differences in the women. One woman quoted as saying that it really hurt her feelings what he told her, that she was getting fat and needed to diet. And another woman who said, you know, he was just trying to remind me to be my best. One of the women that is quoted in this article was a girlfriend. Her name was Roanne Brewer Lane, and I guess a girlfriend in the 90s, the first time they ever met, he asked her to change into a bikini. He commented on her appearance, paraded her in front of other people that were at this social gathering, and said something about, I'm trying to find and I'm not seeing the exact quote, but something about her being a real Trump woman. This same person, Ms. Brewer Lane, came out a couple of days ago and said she felt that the article completely misrepresented what she was saying, that she felt like this was an attack piece in the New York Times. It had not been represented to her that way, that her comments were taken out of context, etc. And all of that may be really true, or there's that suspicious part of me that wonders whether she was told that she needed to come out and say these things. From what I have read about Donald Trump, who honestly is a failed businessman, more failures than successes, who got started because his multimillionaire father, gave him his start. I lost my train of thought. I apologize, but it seems to me that he has engaged in, or has had others on his behalf engage in, bullying in order to get his way. For example, golf course in Scotland. I don't remember where in Scotland. I'm not going to remember all the details. I just remember seeing a story about a farmer, a sheep farmer, who did not want to sell the land that Trump really wanted to have as part of this golf course. And so he just refused to sell. And so the intimidation practices started, including apparently playing extremely loud music pointed right at this gentleman's farm and his sheep, loud explosive noises, threats, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As well as, I recall, very early on, a building, I don't know which one, in New York City, that Trump wanted to build, and there was the lone holdout of an old woman who had lived in her building for decades and decades and decades, didn't want to leave, and she was intimidated to the point of, just exhaustion. And I think she finally gave in, or she died. I don't remember which, but so given that, and given the many, many statements that Trump has made, even during this campaign, about women's appearance, the wives of other candidates and their appearance, I kind of wonder whether Ms. Brewer Lane was encouraged, in quotes, to come forward and say that her statements were taken out of context and that she was misrepresented in this article, or the New York Times article. I basically, at this point, really don't have a whole lot else to say. We have a few more minutes of time left before Sync Sound System comes on at 8 o'clock with our host, Adrian. And so what I'm going to do is just pull up some music, hopefully, and just play us out with some tunes. I hope that you have enjoyed this particular episode of The Midwatch. I presume that Stan will be back next week. Again, Stan, I hope everything's okay, and we look forward to your return. Again, community radio run by volunteers at its finest, folks. Here I am struggling to get some music on. And I'm just going to... I apologize. I'm having a hard time with this. All right. I'm going to play some... I'm going to play some Aretha, I think. And it looks like Adrian just walked in. So we're going to let Aretha play us out. And coming up next, Sync Sound System. Thanks.
Train coming. Don't need no baggage. You just get on board. All we need is faith to hear the diesels humming. Don't need no ticket. We'll just thank the Lord.
Thank the Lord.
People get ready. Picking up passengers from coast to coast. Faith is the key. Open the doors and border. Yes, I'll fall among his love and more.
Fire, and I saw some, like, dry brush and leaves around, so, you know, I said to move the bonfire somewhere else, and out of nowhere, Smokey Bear shows up and hugs me.
So you noticed some wildfire hazards.
and moved your bonfire to a safer location.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Smokey, all right. He likes when people help prevent wildfires. It hits him close to home. Not everybody gets the hug, my friend. So that's pretty special to get a hug from Smokey Bear.
Ha, so it was him. Hey, guys, I told you it was Smokey.
Okay, well, congratulations, my friend. And thanks for calling. There are many ways to prevent a wildfire. Learn how you can do your part at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.